Just a quick review of where we are with the Psalms as we get started with the sermon this morning. Last week, I started a four-week series on the Psalms, focusing on the lectionary selected Psalms for the month of August. In each case, week by week, I am taking a key statement or affirmation from that particular Psalm and recasting it as a question. So from last week, the statement turned question was, God's steadfast love endures forever? From Psalm 107. This week, as you know, the scriptures from Psalm 50, and the statement I want to turn into a question is the one from the end of verse 1 that you repeated during the responsive reading this morning. God shines forth. Now, if you don't have much background with the Psalms, it may be helpful to know that there are different categories of Psalms, but how many there are depends on who you talk to. Some experts say there are three main categories of Psalms. Others say five or even seven. Some of these categories could include Psalms of praise, Psalms of lament, Psalms of thanksgiving, royal Psalms, and wisdom Psalms. But Psalm 50, the Psalm for this morning, doesn't seem to fit neatly into any of those categories. One interpreter I consulted called it a covenant Psalm. That could be a possibility because the message of this psalm seems to be directed to the people of Israel who have made and then broken a covenant with God. While some psalms are entirely voiced by the people who are singing the psalm or who are speaking the psalm, in this one, God's voice shows up beginning in verse 5. Gather to me my faithful ones who made a covenant with me by sacrifice. And then continuing on in verse 7, God says this, Hear, O my people, and I will speak. O Israel, I will testify against you. I am God, your God. Clearly, this is the displeased voice of God. The people of Israel have been making physical, material sacrifices, burnt offerings on the altar, but God is not pleased with this. Because it seems they have just been going through the motions. They do the rituals, but where are their hearts in all of this? What are their true motives? Where is their spiritual integrity? Where is their sacrifice of thanksgiving, as the psalmist puts it in verse 14? It's not an unfamiliar dynamic between God and God's people. You probably realize this, especially if you are acquainted with the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures. In the story of God and God's chosen people, there seems to be a repeated pattern. God reaches out, God rescues, the people are saved, the people are grateful, then the people forget, then they act in ways that take them out of the fold. Then God sends prophets to declare God's displeasure, to call the people back. Sometimes they respond directly, but often they can't seem to learn their lessons except through the hard way, through suffering, through acts of self-destruction. Finally, whether by learning from that suffering or simply becoming aware, the people return to relationship with God, and God welcomes them back, heals their wounds, and once again shows them how to live in God's way. So it's this cycle, covenant made, covenant broken, covenant revisited and restored. It's a cycle of people lost and then found, a cycle of forgetting and remembering, a cycle of rejection and redemption and renewal. On more than one occasion, these people who keep wandering away, who keep deliberately turning away from God, are called stiff-necked people because it seems they are stubbornly bent on their own destruction. They choose the empty sacrifice or the hypocritical behavior or the dishonest ritual rather than choosing a right and real relationship with God. This keeps causing the covenant to break down and merits questions like these. What does real relationship look like? If you keep doing things to create distance between us, can it truly be said that we have a covenantal relationship, a real and life-giving relationship, something that brings clearer light and deeper love to our shared life. I read an opinion piece this week by an essayist who was reflecting about her painful relationship with her in-laws. Their politics have always been different from hers, she says, but in the last couple of years, their rhetoric has become so inflamed with anti-immigrant statements and overt racism and conspiracy theories that she worries now about their influence on her children, their grandchildren. In the essay, she says she's fast reaching the point where she believes that her in-laws will never change for the better, so the relationship may be irreparably damaged. Quote, once it occurred to me that this problem was going to haunt me forever, I started brainstorming solutions in hope of not having to cut them out of our lives. Except in the case of this deep kind of intolerance, there's no solution. They have become completely indoctrinated. And what's worse, they really don't seem to care. They know that there are consequences to all of this, but still they pursue a course of belief that seems at odds with morality. This woman has clearly drawn a line, if not in the sand, then at least in her own mind. She tried a time or two to confront what was going on, but it didn't go well, and she certainly saw that it didn't make any difference. Something is now broken between her and her in-laws. She confesses that she no longer answers the phone in the evening when she sees that it's her mother-in-law calling, and that her husband really only talks to his mother anymore when he's driving home from work. But then she says these two things, and put together these two statements, sum up the struggle of being caught between relationships of long standing and deeply held values. They sum up the struggle of what to do with your people when the covenant has become so damaged by poisonous thoughts and behaviors that you can't see how to restore it, nor can you see how to let it go. She says, on the one hand, what if the next time my mother-in-law or father-in-law says something racist or sexist or homophobic, my young son hears it? And what if hearing something like this from a person he loves and trusts means that he accepts as normal something that should absolutely not be normal? But then she says, on the other hand, you can break up with a boyfriend, you can end a friendship, but how do you stop a family member from being a family member? I mention this because it illustrates that a covenant relationship can be a tough place to live. And the relationship of family is not just a blood relationship, a genetic tie, it's the tie of covenant. An agreement you made to love and honor each other inch by inch and day by day, and to be in each other's lives in positive and sustaining ways. It's a relationship of learning and value expressing and teaching and influencing. It's the looking out for each other over the years relationship. And what if such a relationship, instead of lifting us up, drags us down? What if instead of bringing more light, it casts everything into shadow? I said last week, you might remember, that John Philip Newell made the claim that God would love him no less than his own granny, his own grandmother. He said his grandmother always loved him, forgave him, was not always pleased with him, but stuck with him, and wasn't that a good example of how God loves us? I would imagine that the grandmothers amongst us were glad for the good press that day. But what if Granny's talk, as in the example from my essayist this morning, what if her attitude, her take on morality, instead of being sacred, is toxic? What happens to the covenant of family then? I would say that there is equivalency between God's struggles with God's people, as we read about it in the Hebrew Scriptures, which are the context for the Psalms, and our struggles with our people. Mutual understandings, core values, moral commitments all get stretched sometimes, and sometimes even get stretched so far that they can snap. And when that happens, then the people we've covenanted to be connected to may become for us people we are stuck with. And they may even become people we can't stand. And then where are we? I would also suggest that it is evident from the Psalms that because God values covenant and God values the people God has chosen for covenant, that God also understands feelings of disappointment with those who stop listening, those who stop caring, those who forget what mercy and kindness look like. God understands what it feels like when the covenant breaks down because of dishonesty or hypocrisy or lack of commitment. And God also understands how hard it is to bring the relationship back. There's no easy way to push things in the right direction. Yelling for attention, demanding obedience, these things are more often than not ineffective and maybe even more alienating. So while there is an intensity to a text like the Psalm for this morning, I wonder if what might seem to be only anger, "Hear, O my people, I will speak, O Israel, I will testify against you," might actually be just as much a cry of anguish. That is, when the relationship between God and humanity breaks down, God is suffering too. The anger is born of anguish. The intensity in scriptures like this wouldn't be there if the relationship didn't matter so much. That's true for the essayist I mentioned as well. The intensity wouldn't be there if those grandparents didn't matter so much. Okay, I've talked all this time, and I haven't said a word about the phrase I began with, the statement turned into a question, God shines forth. Haven't said anything about that, but it's still the question, isn't it? When covenants seem worn and frayed, even torn, when hate speech becomes normalized and bigotry is so readily justified and excused, when families can't figure out how to talk to each other, much less honor each other, when stiff-necked people turn from God's mercy and justice and at the same time claim they are doing God's work, when the covenant to be God's people of justice and peace seems to be pushed to the back burner or even pushed entirely to the side, is it still true that God shines forth? God shines forth? Is God's holy and healing light shining in the world right now? Does God shine forth when so much is so broken and so many are so self-indulgent and self-excusing and self-justifying, when so many sacrifices seem so false and gratitude has nearly disappeared from the God and human relationship? Does God shine forth? If God shines forth, it will only be because we see what's going on around us and we are willing to shine a holy light on it. Can we do that? Or have we lost our ability as a church, as a culture, to know or maybe even care as deeply as God cares about what is moral and what is right? Can our culture, for example, even tell the difference anymore between what is political power and what is moral imperative? What things are happening these days that need to be identified through the light of God, identified and named and resisted, so that the way, God's way of honest and holy relationship might again be followed? Can we cast a bright light on motive? On our own motives to begin with, but then also on the motives and maybe even more importantly, the actions of the culture influencers. These days, it feels like it's not just the covenant between God and God's people that has been frayed and even broken by what passes as Christianity within our culture today. It's the covenant of our country, the covenant of our democracy, the covenant of our communities. What happened to give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free? What happened to come to me, all you that are weary and carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest? God shines forth. We had little ants in our kitchen recently, just little tiny ants, the littlest ones I've ever seen. I've heard them called sugar ants, but they're apparently all different varieties of the little buggers that fall under that label. At first, we saw them around the sink. Where were they coming from? I read online that they are, of course, looking for sugar, but they need water, so don't be surprised to find them around the sink. And there they were, a few here and a few there, not a huge number, but always enough to be troublesome. You couldn't put a dish in the sink with the tiniest morsel of food on it without the little ants finding it. We put out some ant bait, ant poison, on little cardboard cards close to the sink. Little ants found it. Great, except they didn't go away. Where were they coming from? From in the sink? From under the edge of the sink? Then one day we found the ants on a completely different counter in the kitchen, far from the sink. There were a bunch of them. It was late in the evening, time for bed really, but we had this ant crisis on our hands. I looked closely. I still couldn't figure it out. Then I took out my phone and I turned on the flashlight, and lighting up the ants carefully followed the trail. It wound around the counter. Some places it was like a little ant highway. Other places they were walking single file. It zigged and zagged this way and that. I kept the light on it, and eventually I saw where it led, behind the counter by the door, the source of the trouble. I don't like ants, not in the house anyway, but I had to see them before I could deal with them. I had to shine the light on them to see them to their source. I think sometimes that spiritually we are living the life of the distracted. We look this way and that and can't seem to figure out where things are coming from, much less where they are headed. It doesn't occur to us to intentionally and continually shine a light on the situation, to light it up. That's what the essayist I mentioned before is trying to do. She concludes her thoughts with these words: "I've struggled with the decision to air my dirty laundry in such a public manner. Yes, I'm an essayist, and the nature of my job is largely confessional, but I believe that it would be disingenuous to keep things that are difficult off of the page. I also believe firmly that the current illness this nation faces fully depends upon so-called decent people doing nothing in the face of grave moral perversity." She says, "What I need to be sure of 20 years from now when I look at my grown children down the telescope of our lives is that I did everything I could to protect them from evil, everything to make their lives bright, happy, and productive. I need to be sure that I didn't contribute to a worse world, that I left things a little better off for them." Maybe a psalm like this helps us in that direction. Maybe a psalm like this is one that not only speaks of God shining forth, but serves to shine a light on us, on our lives, on our world, into the dark places within and around us, a light of accountability that shines on broken covenants, a light of honesty that shines on words of falsehood, a light of gratitude that shines on attitudes of self-centeredness, a light of holiness that shines on all the profane and hateful things that are being put forward. God shines forth? Yes. God shines a light on all falsehood and hypocrisy. God shines a light on all darkness and dishonesty. God shines a light that shows the difference between the sacrifice that is simply a ritual and the sacrifice that comes from a heartfelt place of trust and commitment to the good. God shines a light that shows the difference between rejection and redemption. And you, don't you be afraid to shine that light. Don't be afraid to step into that light. Be honest and grateful and courageous. Check and test your own motives. Be real in your faith and in your faithfulness. You remember Jesus' words from the Sermon on the Mount? You are the light of the world. Let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. Psalm 50 ends with these words, "To those who go the right way, I will show the salvation of God." God shines forth? Yes. Step into the light. Amen.